Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. On today's show, Albuquerque's newly elected mayor says our just-finished bus rapid transit system is, quote, a bit of a lemon. We'll ask Mayor Keller if it can be turned into lemonade. Mayor Tim Keller, we are so pleased you could join us. Welcome.
Great to be here with you.
So before we get to Albuquerque Rapid Transit, a.k.a. ART, I'm interested in your take as the newly elected mayor. What's your take on it? It's a lot different than your prior positions as a senator or your last position as a state auditor. So how do you like it?
Well, I think that's a story of I very much think I am going to love it. right now, as expected, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I think it's something that I've been, in a way, sort of been training for indirectly, you know, in my career, both professionally and politically.
Yeah, so I feel political, that it's politics and also numbers, too. So as state auditor, you're very, I'm sure, comfortable with numbers at this point.
Absolutely. It's very true. But there is, like any job, there's a learning curve. And I think one thing that's awesome is, you know, our city, just by design, it's a large city government. There's 6,000 employees. There's about $1 billion budget. And I remember on the campaign trail, I used to say that, you know, it would be naive to think that you can turn that ship around in 1 year. And, you know, it's totally true. I can verify that statement. It just takes a while to get up and running, get your people in place and your initiatives in place. But I do believe somewhere around early summer, we're going to have the people in place, our plan mapped out, and we're off and running for the remainder of
our term. Well, in general, people have been very impressed with your hires, the people you put in positions.
We found some really good folks, and I think a great mix of experience and innovation and freshness, and also I think across gender and diversity, we've done a good job.
So, and that's also a big part of what you've done.
Very grateful for all of those folks giving me a chance and for being willing to step into, you know, a city that has a lot of challenges.
Yeah, so one advantage you have is that the city council is 6D, 3R. So you have, city council votes don't always break down that way, but, you have six people who, at least in theory, would be sympathetic with your general outlook on things.
In theory, that's true.
Right.
You know, when I was in the Senate, I was a Democrat. We had a Democrat majority, but I learned there that, and you alluded to this, individual voting is much more nonpartisan than people think. And the more local you get, the more it plays out. So even in the state legislature, we had various kind of coalition, different effects on issues. And I think on city council, too, we see dynamics across all sorts of lines, whether it's geographic districts, more rural, more suburban, you know, even personal backgrounds are different and people kind of align along that way. So I have found it it is very unpredictable, even though people have a D or an R next to their name.
So let's just talk about the most controversial decision thus far, which is the decision by the city council to increase the gross receipts tax by 0.375%. Now, you campaigned, as I understand it, that you would go to the voters if there was going to be an increase. And the city council arguably did you a big favor, but they voted 8-1. That's a veto-proof majority. Right?
That's right. Yeah, you know, they didn't give me a choice at the end, and so it doesn't really matter what I said, or I had to laugh because I know some of the people covered how the bill was signed. When it's an 8-1 vote, it doesn't matter if the mayor signs it or not, you know. So in the end, it really wasn't a choice, and I do think things should go to the voters, especially a tax increase. But I think it's important to note that I respect where council was coming from, and of course, we supplied them with a lot of the information, but
That was a very persuasive presentation you made, because I looked at it, about the $40 million basic deficit. There was a $25 million structural deficit and then another $15 million in increased costs that you were looking at right away, right? $40 million.
Yeah, and I think it's a reflection of, you know, historically they had tried to kind of nickel and dime their way out of these structural holes. And actually, in many ways, they did a great job of stringing that along. But I think what councilors also realized is it was inevitable. You can't have a structural deficit like that unless there's a huge economic boom right away. They knew that they had to do this. I think they were just waiting for a mayor to sort of stand back and let them
do it.
And also, you know, there was a piece around timing. So we looked at going to a vote. And, you know, what our attorneys showed is that the soonest we could get the revenue actually in the door and use it would be about September 2019. So if you're concerned about public safety, about behavioral health, about homelessness, basically what that's saying is that
– what you ran on.
Yeah. Everything I ran on, I couldn't do till September 2019. And so I think that urgency, it just has to do with the tax rules of the state. Once we discovered that, I think people realized, look, you know, you learn. And what we learned is that if you want any progress on anything I ran on, you have to get that money in the door sooner.
So as you indicated just a moment ago, the sort of bottom line in terms of how we're going to do it with our budget is kind of how we're going to do as a city and how we're going to progress economically. And that kind of brings us to ART, because ART, because that was at least Mayor Berry's sort of vision of economic development, at least a large part of what he thought economic development should be. And in early March, you gave a sort of an update on ART. And that's when I'll just call it the bit of a lemon update.
Mm-hmm.
But before we get right to that, I wonder if you would mind just sort of describing what ART is for those Albuquerqueans who haven't made it down to Central or out of towners.
Sure. Well, it is essentially it's a bus system that just goes up and down Central. It's essentially a bus route fundamentally. Mm-hmm. But it's set up such that it's a small start to light rail. And this is what the feds view it as. So we built these big concrete stops in the middle of Central. And we changed the asphalt and the traffic patterns such that all we would ever have to do light rail is just lay in the track and buy the cars. So the most expensive infrastructure for light rail, we already invested in through this project.
Wow. Now, I had no idea that was true.
Yeah, that's the basis of all of these small start grants.
I see.
And why the design criteria is such that it is. But in the short term, the idea is you run a bus, which is much, much cheaper. So you do the infrastructure for a light rail or a bus up front, and then you do a bus until you're ready, and then you convert to light rail. And so that's what a lot of other cities have done. That's kind of the program. That's why the infrastructure investment was so heavy, all the light changes. And you just think of the ripping up of the street and all the concrete. That's all so we don't have to do that when we go to light rail. That's the idea. At least that's the concept, you know.
So the system is nonetheless very much like a rapid transit system. That is, there's medians where you do, where there's fare collections, or stations where there's a pre-boarding fare collection. There's there's an intelligent light system, right? So that buses that run down the center of Central have priority. The top of the stations meets the floor of the bus, so people can walk, in theory, right on the bus. So I sort of spent most of my life in Chicago, and this was very much like the L,
mm-hmm.
in terms of rapid transit.
Yeah, and in theory, that is exactly how it's supposed to work. And,
yeah.
You know, I think that all those promises were sort of made.
Yes.
Even out of the string of things you mentioned, I think at least a third of those aren't even true. But those were the promises that were made.
So, yeah, let's get to the concept.
That's the concept they were going after.
Yeah. So what are the things that aren't true?
Well, for example, the timing of the lights, or that they'd sort of have priority.
Yeah, that's not true.
No, it's today. It's not. We would still like to do that. But either between cost cutting or technology changes, that actually was never put in. It was part of the original process. It's not right now. Yeah, and I actually think that's one of the key parts to it. You know, so that is something we're looking at. But it just isn't part of what I walked into on December 1. Now, the other thing is that the question, which we'll dive into this, there's lots of details, but we like to call it the sort of good, the bad, and the ugly. So right now, the good news is the construction is basically done. And we've corrected some of the engineering flaws, and we're finishing up some things on the stop, so they'll all be ready to go. You know, I think the bad news is that the funding is not guaranteed. The good part of that is that the federal budget passed, which has funding in it, but that money is for the grant program through the FTA. It is not specifically for Albuquerque. So it just means the choice on whether or not we get the dollars is up to the FTA. And historically, the FTA would say, well, we're waiting on Congress to give us the money. Now that's not true anymore. Congress did their part, our delegation did their part, and FTA has the money. But these grants are literally given there a choice by the FTA. So they could just say, well, you meet all the criteria, but we prefer, you know, Austin. It's their choice.
So I want to come back and ask you a few more questions about that, but let me just
mention. Sure, we can do the ugly part later.
Yeah, right. Oh.
there's still more.
Why don't you do the ugly part?
Okay. So, well, the ugly part is the buses.
Let me just mention, if you just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm really pleased that in the studio with me is Mayor Tim Keller, and we're talking about Albuquerque Rapid Transit, and we're talking about the good, the bad, and the ugly. The bad was the money, right?
Yeah, but that got a lot better. We're halfway there. We got the money from Congress.
So I find this really weird. You know, is there a step that we missed? I mean, how do you – if you're the Federal Transit Authority and you're trying to encourage, you know, infrastructure spending by municipalities, you just leave the municipalities out there just hanging and they never actually know if they're going to get the money?
Well, you're raising, I think, this has been the challenge with what we walked into. We are the only city in America that built the project and then is trying to get grant funding.
You're kidding.
Everyone else planned the project and then applied for grant funding before building it. So we built this thing on spec.
We didn't have to.
We could have waited. We never had a guarantee. We would get these things called letters of no prejudice. And that just means that you know, it's like getting pre-approved for credit. They say we meet all the criteria for the grant, but in the letter it says funding is not guaranteed. It says it in every single letter. And it says like you're building at your own risk. And that's exactly what we did. Now, I do think there's a subtle nuance here. Under the Obama administration, this was pretty routine. And so they were making a bet, the past administration, that sort of that would continue. And I think it was a fairly safe bet.
Hillary Clinton would get elected and everything would continue?
Well, I don't know if they were that thoughtful about it. But I think this was a pretty routine program. And usually when you got that letter of no prejudice, then you're fine. However, we have a different administration and their priorities are very different. And that's why in hindsight, I mean, they never should have done that. We never should have built this on spec. That's clear.
So a recent article in the Journal said that the Federal Transit Authority got $400 million of small starts money, and we're trying to get like $75 million of that. So that's almost 20% of it. I mean, that alone is troublesome if we're competing against all these other projects for the money. We may well not get the full $75 million if we get any of it.
Well, it truly will be up to the FTA, and they have, I think, I forget if it's 6 or 9 other projects that kind of applied for this and are in the queue. And so how they divide it up and so forth is up to them. But one good thing is administratively, like with the FTA folks regionally and our folks, we actually have a very good relationship. Our paperwork is going to be up to date. We'll be in full compliance. So we do feel hopeful. But, you know, it's still kind of a 50-50 shot.
So where did the money come from? I know there was like at least $13 million in bonding that was used to pay for all this. But where did all the rest of the money come from to actually pay for all the construction that you talked about earlier in the show?
You know, the specific answer is it came from essentially bond money that hadn't been spent. So if we don't get this money paid, it means that future projects that we already bonded for, whether it's stop signs or parks or whatever, we won't have enough money to do them. The irony, though, is part of this has to do with what I raised at the state auditor's office in this notion that cities and state governments have all this unspent capital outlay. And it's not that it's not allocated. It just hasn't been spent. And they actually use that exact issue to fund, essentially loan us money, hoping that we get grant reimbursed. They borrowed against themselves using that pot of unspent money. And so it's just a little bit of an irony because as state auditor, I was the one calling them out for having so much money.
Yeah, I remember when you did that.
And basically what they did with it is loan themselves money to pay for the art.
All right. Time for – if that's not bad enough, it's time for the ugly.
Mm. Yeah. So the ugly is, you know, this bus company, BYD, which of course stands for Build Your Dreams. In another twist that, you know, I could never have predicted, this is one of the largest bus companies in the world. They are Chinese owned and they make, you know, lots and lots of buses with no issues. However, they have never made a American 60-foot electric bus. And the 60-foot buses are the ones that are – they call it articulated in the middle, like rapid rides. But the issue is the doors open on a different side because of our median loading, and then it's electric, and they're doing this in America with a different set of standards. So this is their first time, even though they've been doing this forever. This is their first time, and basically I think even they would agree there's a host of issues. You know, the frames are cracked. The axles are leaking. There's a lot of small things around like seatbelts and different safety measures for ADA that they originally hadn't done. Buses are coming without seats being completed, but they want to assemble them here in Albuquerque. And all of the buses were late and we're still waiting on at least six. And we sent back six that they sent because they weren't adequate. So, you know, we were just kind of sold a bill of goods on these. But I'm not sure if the company predicted that. I don't think they realized how difficult this was going to be. And, you know, there were a lot of choices that I would have done differently had I been here last year. But I can't imagine any city administrator would wish what has happened with these buses upon their city. But nonetheless, we're under contractual agreement with these folks. So you can't just walk away without a huge penalty. So that's why it's so ugly.
So presumably they're working to try to correct these problems, and they'd like to sell electric buses to other people, and they'd certainly like to point to us as a successful purchaser, right?
Right. The good news is the incentives are aligned, right? We want buses that work.
We want buses.
And they don't want to, you know, tank their entire North American operations because now the whole country is watching us to see if they want to keep buying their BYD buses. So that's a good thing, and I think it's created space for some solutions. What we're doing is, one, using the contract that's in place to send back buses that don't meet criteria, and so that's just a
– And they don't seem to be fighting you on this. They seem to be working with you.
And that's, I think, the one thing about them is they know that they've got to do a lot better, and so they are working with us on that. But, of course, it's delaying the project, right? So this is why you know, we are hopeful sometime in 2018 we'll be up and running, but anywhere – more detailed or narrow than that, we don't know because it depends how fast they can get us good buses.
I see.
And they've missed every deadline they've set. So when they say we'll get them to in March, we're kind of like, okay, well, we'll talk about that in April. You know. So the last thing I had to share on these buses is that, you know, I love folks know, I think, my environmental track record and innovation and sustainability, and I'm very interested in the electric buses. I mean, that was actually a very progressive move by the last administration. But this technology is very new for buses, and there's this recharge issue. And so we have, if you think of the mountains and the volcanoes, our buses are going uphill a lot, and it's draining these batteries. And they're not meeting the spec, but also we might not even be able to run this system on electric buses because the technology for batteries just isn't there yet. So we are looking at the possibility of like a mixed fleet to kind of diversify away that risk. Because I think fundamentally the notion that electric buses are ready for this particular bus route, they're just not meeting any of the requirements. And so that does put the whole concept of a 100% electric bus line in question. I don't know if that's scientifically possible right now.
Yeah, and that was like a big part of the whole enhanced ridership idea that, you know, you were going to be on a completely different kind of bus.
Yeah.
So that just may not turn out.
Right. I mean, I think in the long term, we can phase it in. We can wait for technology to catch up. And I think folks can certainly be assured that there are going to be higher technology buses. And we're committed to making several of them at least electric. I mean, we want to get – as long as we can get some of these buses that actually work, we're going to do that. But to have the whole line running on that, You know, all the math is based on a 275 mile an hour charge time or mm-hmm. charge length for the batteries. Right now they're hitting 200. And percentage-wise, that means we'd need like five more buses to run the route, which obviously costs more money and we can't even get the current ones in. So there is like this battery capacity problem that they've got. And that is the ugliest part of all of this equation.
Well, if you've just tuned in, this is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have Tim Keller in the studio with me, and we're talking about art, Albuquerque Rapid Transit. And, you know, art was really sold to us by the prior administration as a economic development project. It was just a transit project that was going to lead to all this economic development. And we were told about huge sums of economic development that would happen, maybe $3 billion overall, $1 billion in the art corridor along Central. And I'm just wondering, now that you've come in and you've taken a fresh look at this, what you make of it.
Well, I think one thing I've been trying to do in this office is not overpromise and not try and sell projects in a sort of marketing sense. I think mm-hmm. things should stand on their own without the additional marketing and pumping up. And I think the numbers that were thrown around, you know, I used to do a lot of this economic estimating in my professional job before I got into government. And, you know, I can come up with any number you want for economic development based on the inputs and the multipliers and this kind of thing. But I will say this, there are studies that show that if you have a light rail system, people will essentially build and develop around that. That is a known fact, and that's why light rail tends to be more successful at revitalizing areas than buses. And this is essentially a cheaper way to do that, or a gateway towards that. So I do think the concept is sound. But also right here in Albuquerque, you know, there are some areas we like the way they are. And so, you know, there is an open question about if, you know, what type of development are we talking about? Are we talking about mixed-use housing and entrepreneurial opportunities? Or are we talking about fast food and, you know, strip malls? And so I do think that when we actually get this thing running and our city is experiencing a little bit of a renewed vibrancy, you know, then we've got to be sensitive to issues around gentrification and things like that. There's a real rub there. I think because the project is so delayed and taking so long and has all these challenges, you know, those are challenges in the future. That kind of development matters. What kind of development matters? And I think that's something that remains to be seen. But I know in our office, we're going to be sensitive to, because we want a increased economy. But we want an economy that lifts everyone up and that also isn't trying to artificially inflated by cheap construction.
So how do you do that? How do you, you know, I mean, you know, economies are the invisible hand guides economies. So how do you, you know, in planning, try to create the kinds of businesses and development that you'd like to create?
I think there's a couple of ways. One is actually listening to neighborhoods, and especially in some of these areas where there's like business districts, Knob Hill and so forth, and West Downtown, and really following the vision that they've laid out for their community. So my view is you let the community create their own path forward. And that might be different for each community. Some of our historical neighborhoods are also like that. You know, what does this look like for them? And I think it's okay if this looks different along different parts on the route, because the communities are unique in many ways. And so it should be a unique tour through Albuquerque. So I think if we can honor that kind of community input process, and then we can layer in the planning and zoning work that a city does to actually reinforce that, we can do this right.
So Edo, the Integrated Development Ordinance, is that an attempt to do this? And that's supposed to go into effect very soon, right?
Yes, and conceptually they are related, but literally they're not. In other words, IDO was its own project and ART was its own project. But IDO is another thing that we walked into. I mean, that bill had already passed.
Right.
And I know there's some changes that folks, I think even on city council, are trying to do. But it does go into effect no matter what, I mean, unless there's some court injunction or something, it goes into effect, I think, July 1st. And so we're going to have that. And I think hopefully our orientation towards listening to communities and doing thoughtful, broad-based development in a brownfield way, so in a way of investing in the core of our city as opposed to in the suburbs, if we can actually do those things, I think we might be okay with IDO. But, you know, I know that did – unfortunately, it did eliminate a lot of the local community plans, right? Even in my own international district, the sector plans and so forth.
Where
so,
you were senator.
Right. But those are gone. And, you know, I do think that's one of those things where unless we've got five votes to change the ordinance some other way, it's going to take five votes. So that really is, I guess, one for council. What we can work on is how to implement it in the most community-friendly way possible.
So you seem fairly skeptical of the economic benefits of art. I mean, the concept makes sense to you, but you're not really sure in practice if it's really going to work as well as certainly as it was sold to us by the prior administration.
I think it's going to be a long road. I believe in public transit, and I believe investing in public transit is a good idea. So the fact that we have, you know, fiber cables laid all down Central. We've got new landscaping and new asphalt on Route 66. Those are good things. We're getting new buses. Those are good things. The bus routes are going to be faster. That's a good thing, too. These are all, I think, in the right direction. And so that's why in the long term, I'm optimistic. But in the short term, there are just a lot of things that unfortunately have divided our community, right? And they've made folks less willing to go down to Central. And I think that's one message I would say that is an attitude issue. I want Albuquerque to realize Central is open for business. Those businesses are still there. They're awesome. There actually is just as much parking as before. It just is a little harder to find, but it's there and we'll work on that. And we need to do a whole public awareness campaign. But I think our Route 66 is awesome. And if we can get through, I think, the short-term design issues and all of this, I think we're going to realize that we have a treasure along Route 66. And that's something that I've always wanted to promote and celebrate. And I think in the end, will be a defining characteristic of our city.
So one thing I read that really surprised me was that by 2040, 22 years from now, there's supposed to be another 500,000 people in the Albuquerque metro area. And that obviously that's going to increase density. That's going to increase the desire for public transport. There'll be more millennials. There'll be more seniors. I mean, it seems like that really argues strongly for some form of public transport. And Central is that's the basic route, right? Over 40% of bus riders right now are on Central.
Absolutely.
So all that makes sense to you.
It does, and so does a crossing route. You know, if you're looking at 2040, right, you've got to have in any public transit system, there has to be, essentially a cross of an east and west, north, south, or whatever directions you want to do it. But for us, it's very natural, and it's something that I want to lay the groundwork for. We've got to run, essentially, if you go from the airport to the UNM hospitals, those are all high-trafficked areas that people would ride public transit for. And in some cases, because the hospital need public transit, that line crosses Central right through University. And to me, I think there's also a missing element that they forgot in this whole planning process, which is that in any major city, the gateway drug to people riding public transit for the first time is a sporting event. And ours can go right past the Isotopes Park and the football stadium and the basketball stadium. And if we can ever do that, I will tell you, that is what increases ridership. You want to know what folks in the Heights or on the West Side will ride the bus to? A game. That's how you get people riding it. And that's how every other city has done this, usually with like a downtown stadium. But for us, it's at least nice that there's an axis of airport, stadiums, hospital, right, University. And I think if we do that, we've actually got a viable public transit system that's ready for growth.
Yeah. So if you increase connectivity, you can get back and forth from the airport to these stadiums, to Old Town, to UNM. Now you've got what looks like a transit system as opposed to just one spine of a transit system, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So we're nearing the end of the show, and I always like to ask an unfair question at the end of the show. So in three years or so, when you might be running again for your next term, what do you think we're going to be saying about art, and what do you think we're going to be saying about economic development in Albuquerque, which has had this lost decade of 10 years?
You know, I think in 3 years, I hope folks are going to say, we got it up and running, and it actually is going to be a benefit for our city. You know, despite all the pain that we did the right things to get it up because we had already committed to it, and that going forward, it's at least going to be an asset. And then I believe that people will also say our economy is picking up. I think we're a young city. We're a hip city. We actually get a lot of press now on being trendy and cool. And that's the beginning to a platform that is about economic growth, particularly from millennials and even baby boomers and their entrepreneurial activities. So I actually think we're positioned well, and I think we're going to start feeling that over the next few years. Also, because all the major cities around us too, you know, their real estate prices are skyrocketing. They have all sorts of urban issues, and I think people are going to realize that we've got a whole lot more to offer, and we've been overlooked.
We are going to have to leave it there. I would like to thank Mayor Tim Keller for taking the time to speak with us. Thanks also to my engineer, Marshall Broyles. Our executive producer is Lynn Shebeki. My name is Stephen Spitz, and you've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. Podcasts of my shows are available at iTunes. Search Stephen Spitz. Archives of past shows are at stephenspitz.com. Thanks for listening. See you next time.